Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all here this morning. We're especially delighted to welcome some students that we have with us. We have students from Faith Christian School. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have students from the Wisconsin School for the Deaf. Would they please stand? And thank you all for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program that is sponsored by the State Bar in this court. And under that program, we invite students from around the state to join us for an oral argument. And if they agree to come, they are given briefs of the case that we are about to hear. And they probably do some extracurricular activities involving that case. Another part of that program is the students will meet with a justice of this court after the second oral argument in the morning. The discussion at that session will not be about the substance or substantive issues in the case. The discussion will be about the procedures the court uses in taking and deciding cases. Everyone is welcome to join the students and the justice at that discussion. With those introductory remarks made, let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Patience Robinsack. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. Justice Crooks is the justice with whom you'll meet today after the second case. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. To her left, Justice David Prosser. And on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, we'll have the argument in our first case this morning, 2004-AP-2322, Mark Sunday and Joyce Sunday versus David Cohell Agency, Inc. Arguing on behalf of the Sundays is Attorney John L. DeStefanis. Counsel, you may proceed.
Your Honors, again, my name is John DeStefanis from the City of Milwaukee, and I represent the appellants in this case, Mark and Joyce Sunday. In fact, present with me today is Ms. Sunday, Joyce Sunday, and her son, Kyle. May it please the Court. This case, as the Court has advised, examines the so-called WB-5 commercial listing contract and the meaning and legal effect of several sections of that document. Very briefly, the factual context is that Mr. and Mrs. Sunday have owned two parcels of real estate in Kenosha County along the I-94 corridor. The first parcel, the larger of the two, about 15 acres, which houses or has housed a military museum, which consists of vintage pieces of military equipment. The other parcel has been known as the Sunday's Vans parcel. And on that parcel, the Sundays operated a business where they did custom work to vans, and they also refurbished some of the military equipment from the other parcel. Mr. and Mrs. Sunday entered into a listing contract with the respondent in this case, actually two listing contracts, on May the 15th, 2002. Those listing contracts were for a one-year term, one for each of the two parcels I've indicated. They were standard WB-5 listing contract forms and were pre-typed and prepared by the broker, with one exception, which I think is notable, and these can be viewed at item number 12 of the record, exhibits 5 and 6 to that record 12. And that is that at the time of execution, the Sundays requested that, and there was handwritten in, that occupancy of the parcels had to be negotiated. Now, not too long after that, in fact, just a month later, parties became aware that there may be a possible condemnation by virtue of a redevelopment of that particular corridor in the village of Pleasant Prairie. And
now, when you say the parties, is this all your clients as well as the broker? Because he had stopped, just so I understand the facts, as I understand, he stopped in to talk with, quote, the village authorities, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. That occurred just approximately 2 weeks after the listing contracts were signed. On May 28, 2002, the broker stopped in unsolicited to speak with the village administrator, Michael Polakoff. And at that meeting, or at that visit, the broker asked, suggested to Mr. Polakoff that the village of Pleasant Prairie purchase the Sunday's properties for about $2 million. Mr. Polakoff apparently politely declined that suggestion, and the meeting ended. However, according to the record, on June the 10th of 2002, some 2 weeks approximately, or a little less than 2 weeks approximately after that, Mr. Cole, the broker, learned of the possible condemnation. The record does not disclose, and I'm not aware as to how he learned of that fact, but that is what the record discloses. Sometime between June 10th, 2002 and July 3rd, 2002, Mr. and Mrs. Sunday learned that the village had approved the formation of a community development or redevelopment authority and that this implicated the possibility of condemnation. And having learned that, the Sundays then promptly on July 3rd, 2002, contacted the broker and said, please suspend all of your efforts. Please do nothing further. I believe the broker agreed to that.
Counsel, your argument, at least in part, depends on the definition of the word transaction.
I would certainly agree with that, Your Honor.
This case is about whether a real estate commission is due and owing, and we look to the contract, the commercial listing contract, and it says around line 52 that a commission is due from the seller to the broker if a transaction occurs which causes an effective change in ownership or control. Now, you maintain that the definition of transaction comes from the administrative regulation RL-24, as I understand your argument. Why should that definition be interjected into this contract between the parties?
Your Honor, that is the definition adopted via the rulemaking power of the Department of Regulation and Licensing. The Regulation and Licensing is the administrative agency that approves, creates and approves the WB-5 form. Now, when this form was last amended, which was 2000, I believe, that definition already existed, and we certainly have to assume, and I think the rules of construction would suggest that we assume, that the Department of Regulation and Licensing was well aware of its own definition of the term transaction, and that therefore, when they chose to use that term in the context of this form, it was with that awareness.
But this agreement isn't between an administrative agency and someone else. This agreement is between two private individuals. And why should we incorporate that transaction definition? Why not use an ordinary dictionary definition of the word transaction?
Well, I think in order to yield to the respondent's arguments in this case, one would have to give the broadest possible definition to the term transaction. But I think we cannot lose sight of the fact that, in fact, it was the Department of Regulation and Licensing which adopted this form, was well cognizant of its definition of transaction. And that definition and the forms that the department creates are part of the mission of this administrative agency to protect and serve the public and regulate the real estate profession, not to look out for the economic interests of the real estate profession. And I think this dovetails with what is a seductive quotation. I think it was even mentioned by the Court of Appeals, and that is from the Kazmusik case cited by the respondent. It said something like, a proposed contractual interpretation that would read out of a contract language obviously important to one of the parties ought to face a distinctly uphill struggle. When the Department of Regulation and Licensing drafted this, I don't think it would have been a question of what the respondent in this case or any real estate broker would have wanted by way of a wish list or would have wanted by way of a meaning. I think it was a question of the department drafting a form in the public interest and in terms of a regulated profession.
Secondly, if I might follow through with the question from Justice Bradley, it's my understanding that your opposing counsel says, look, RL 240218 relates to a totally different situation. It relates to the conduct of the licensee, and it really has nothing to do with the transaction here involving a commercial listing contract or agreement. How do you respond to that?
I think that it lies within the context of administrative code provisions that govern all aspects of the practice and conduct of the real estate profession. And again, I don't believe that it's an appropriate conclusion to draw that the agency drafted one definition of transaction in that particular case, but gave that definition no weight, moment, or credence when it set out to draft the form and intended something completely differently in the form.
Well, and even if we agree that you're right in that regard, and that definition of transaction is what we should use here, is that definition so narrow as to exclude what occurred in this case?
Well, the definition makes reference specifically and expressly to sale, exchange, purchase, rent, granting, or acceptance of an option. Now, those are all kinds of voluntary conveyances of an interest in real estate. And it is the appellant's contention that subpoint 5 of the commission clause refers to voluntary conveyances of of various varieties of interest in real estate, but that it should not be read to include involuntary conveyances such as in the case of a condemnation. Now, we also have to bear in mind, Your Honors, that it would have been exceedingly easy for the Department of Regulation and Licensing to have avoided this entire issue if, in fact, the Department had intended to use this broadest concept of the definition of the term transaction. For example, it could have expressly so stated within the four corners of the document, this includes involuntary acquisitions or involuntary conveyances, such as in bankruptcy or such as via foreclosure or anything of that nature. Now, one might say, well, on the other hand, they may have been reluctant to try to enumerate every conceivable factual circumstance that might ever arise in the course of human experience. So there's an alternative way, had the agency intended what respondents suggest to have done so, and that is to have adopted more generalized language. Instead of what line 52 actually says, a transaction occurs which causes an effective change in ownership or control, they could have simply said there is an effective change in ownership or control of all or any part of the property. Just by leaving out the word transaction, they would have avoided this controversy if they had not intended the concept of transaction to adhere to that elsewhere in the administrative code.
Counselor, given the other choices that are in the form for conveyances, what does this refer to if it doesn't refer to a transaction that involves condemnation or some other involuntary exchange?
It could, in fact, refer to a transaction such as, and I have to apologize. The case name escapes me just for a moment, but there was a case decided in this state in which a broker entered into a contract to sell a corporation, I believe it was. And what resulted was the sale, an asset sale. And in that particular case, of course, litigation ensued, and because it didn't precisely deal with what the listing contract had or the contract for commission had, the broker was out of luck. And clearly, that was a result that the court found offensive, as it should. But in any event, that I think that is the kind of circumstance. And that's why they use the language, an effective change of ownership or control. And so it certainly guards against practices or attempts by a seller to get around the commission clause. But I think the emphasis ought to be on that effective ownership or control concept.
Well, what about if somebody dies?
Well, I think if someone did, that's one of the anomalies here. If someone dies or...
Suppose you transfer to a irrevocable trust or a revocable trust.
That is true. And if we look at the broadest and most expansive definition of the term transaction, as the respondent suggests, I would maintain that potentially triggers this commission clause. And I don't think that the Department of Regulation and Licensing intended that for one moment. In fact, there's other anomalous results here of the same kind. For example, what if the CDA in this case had only condemned a narrow strip of the land fronting on the road? Would that have triggered the commission clause in the way that respondent says and lead to a commission based upon the full listing value of the property. I think if you follow respondent's arguments to their illogical conclusion, perhaps, that's the answer you come up with. But again, I don't think that the department intended for the kinds of results, these kinds of anomalous results to obtain.
Counsel, it's my understanding that a part of this record is an affidavit from a Scott Minter, and that affidavit apparently goes to the intent involved with this provision. Is that indeed correct? There is, as part of the record, that affidavit?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
And how would you respond to my understanding, at least, that that affidavit supports the other side here?
I would respond in this way. I don't think that it's appropriate to rely on a subjective affidavit of one member of a forms drafting committee. And the reason I say that is these committees are officially constituted committees. They have a recognized place in this process of drafting these forms. They generate minutes. If you're going to look at what the work of the committee was and what its intentions were, one ought to look at the official minutes and the record of the proceedings, not the subjective recollections of one member of the committee after the fact, even perhaps a valuable or esteemed member such as Professor Minter. That's his opinion as to what may have been intended. And I think even that must give way in the face of the language of the document, reading the various clauses in pari materia to one another, and that, of course, is the exclusion clause, the commission clause, and the extension clause. Those three are all critical in this case and must be read together.
Counselor, is the WB5 in any way an administrative agency's interpretation of its own rule?
I think it would be difficult to suggest that an administrative agency would create a procedure or a form, as in this case, that it intended to be inconsistent with its own rule. So to that extent, it really does track with its own rules, I believe.
Counsel, if there are exceptions in the contract, as far as, I'll just name one, if it was transferred during a divorce proceeding, there wouldn't be a commission. So if it wasn't included, and I think that's on line 62 in the contractual arrangement, in any event, it wasn't included there, and there were exceptions, and this wasn't an exception, then your interpretation would be what? That because it wasn't listed, then you're saying that basically that the transaction, in this case, a condemnation, that there would be no remuneration coming. Does that make sense as far as how you interpret a contract?
If I understand.
In other words, there are exceptions listed in the contract.
I believe, if I understand your question correctly, Mr. Justice, there is one exception, and that is in the case of divorce judgment. And I think that's a very apt question, and I've wrestled with it. Obviously, at least in the case of divorce judgment, the department knew how to create an exception, and they expressly put in that exception. So does that mean that the department intended that anything else that resulted in a change in ownership or control is not an exception? And again, I've wrestled with that question. I'm not sure that there's any good answer to that question other than to say that I think if you look at the three clauses I've mentioned, they are not models of artful drafting here, and they're difficult. And again, if you look at the juxtaposition of the language of those three clauses, I think it weighs just as heavily on the other side as the fact that they created one exception but no more than one. And again, did they intend that passage by probate would not be an exception? Did they intend that condemnation of an easement, for example, or a narrow strip for an easement would result in the entire contract value based on the listing price, that would be the case? I don't think the department did, and yet I realize that they've carved out one exception. They could have, and I think they should have, carved out more. In sound public policy, and because of some of these anomalous results that would otherwise obtain if the trial court here is correct.
Well, the difference is that there's remuneration. In other words, there's money coming whether you have a narrow strip carved out or you have a condemnation. As in this case, there were funds that were exchanged for the property.
Yes.
From A to B.
And certainly, we feel it's unconscionable that the commission here should be based upon the listed price.
Well, that's another argument. That may be true. But I'm saying that there was a remuneration here.
There was condemnation compensation here. Yes, there was. It never amounted to the listing price, and in fact, there's a vast gulf between them.
Well, what was the exact, as I am maybe looking at the different briefs here, I think that your clients received somewhere around $2.4 million. Is that correct?
Well, I would put that number at $2.25 million. The reason being is, yes, Chapter 32 does provide for attorney's fees, reasonable actual attorney's fees, and it does provide for moving expenses, and it does provide for certain other benefits under both Chapter 32 and as elucidated under the administrative code. However, those merely reimburse a condemnee for out-of-pocket expenses. They are mere pass-throughs. And to suggest that it is fair to calculate the commission based on the full listing price because they didn't just get compensation, they also got these additional expenses, those expenses do not end up in the pocket of the condemnee. They go to reimburse him for expenses he's actually incurred.
You have an administrative rule here, and you have this WB-5. Do they have the same legal status?
No. It's very clear under the statutes that the form must give way to the administrative rule. And I've cited that in my brief, and I wish I could locate the statute, but
513. 227.11.2b.
Yes, thank you very much, Your Honor. I appreciate that. Moreover, there is another administrative rule, by the way, RL 16.06, which is entitled How to Use Approved Forms. Subsection 8 thereof says, a licensee shall use approved forms and prepare addenda in such manner as to adequately accomplish the contractual intent of the person for whom the licensee uses the forms, i.e. the client. And I think that's an additional reason why one does not address the meaning or the intent of the form from the perspective of the broker, which is to say everything that the broker might otherwise consider important or want in that form. I think that's another reason why it's important to look at it from the perspective of the consumer or the client.
Counsel, I'm going to ask Justice Press's question in a different way. Rules have to go through a legislative procedure with a committee. Do the forms?
It is. I am not aware that the forms necessarily go through all of the steps in the rulemaking process. I don't believe that that they necessarily have the full public comments and public hearings and so on and so forth. But my understanding is, and again, I certainly cannot indicate to the court that I know this by experience or personal knowledge, but a forms committee does work to assist in creating the form, but ultimately it's approved by the department. But not necessarily with all the formalities of the rulemaking process. And by statute, these forms are not considered rules. They do not have the force of law in the sense that rules do.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll now hear from counsel for Dave Coral Agency, Inc.
Good morning. I'm Susan Margay with the firm of Weiss, Brzozowski, Brady. And Brian Sadek is here, who assisted on the briefs and is available also to answer questions. And we represent Dave Coral Agency, who's here today somewhere, and are happy to engage in this discussion. I find it very interesting. And I'm just going to jump right into some of the issues that have been raised here in the context of appellant's argument. I'm going to start with the principles of contract construction that we believe apply, which are that you apply the plain, ordinary meaning of the language, and line 52 clearly says that a transaction that occurs that results in an effective change of ownership or control of the property would result in a commission. The cases are very clear, the Kearns case, the Pleva case, dispatch automation case, that we don't look to the seller's intent in determining the meaning of the contract.
Counselor, if we're going to talk about principles of contract construction, I wonder, is the word transaction ambiguous?
You could say possibly it is, however.
If it's ambiguous, don't you construe it against the drafter, and isn't that your client?
If the proposed construction against the draftsman is unreasonable, no, you don't. And the case that deals with that is cited here. I've got a citation, in fact, because I thought it was interesting that there's actually a case on it. The case of Columbia Propane versus Wisconsin Gas says that just because a contract has a broad term in it, it's not necessarily ambiguous. There is also a case in here somewhere, and I will get it in a second, that says that just because if you decide that this is ambiguous, that does not mean that you need to construe it against us if the construction that's being proposed is unreasonable. So back to, is this unreasonable or not, and is this ambiguous or not? The broad language that's used here is appropriate, and the Wilkie case says that, in the Pleva case, again, that broad language is appropriate to enable flexibility and to deal with more than one situation. And here I think that was clearly the purpose in using this language, as borne out by the affidavit of Professor Minter. With regard to the question of whether or not this form is law, or whether or not the agency had the authority to do this and to use a term of art that is also included in RL 02 sub 18, I think the cases are very clear. The Metro Holding case that was cited by counsel looked at this very issue. And in Metro Holding case, there was a property assessor's manual that went beyond very specific language that was contained in legislation enacted by the Department of Revenue that controlled how one values property. Here we don't have that. We have absolutely no legislation at all that governs when a broker gets a commission. That's not what the provisions in Chapter 452 governing the standards of conduct for brokers and licensees say. There's nothing in there. There's nothing in any of the provisions of Chapter 24 of RL, the Administrative Code, dealing with it. The only thing that is in there is RL 2408, which just says that commission contracts have to be in writing. So if you want to take that argument to the logic, to its end conclusion, then the definition that's contained in 452.015M, which defines negotiate, would apply here and not the language in the form. And so the definition of negotiate in sub 5M says that any time a broker provides advice, that's negotiation. Well, yes, for purposes of determining whether or not these codes of conduct apply, indeed, it's correct. But that doesn't govern whether or not a contract gets extended. The language in the contract governs that situation.
Well, Ms. Margay, what about the argument of opposing counsel that looks at the definition of transaction in RL 2402.18 and says that definition really conveys the idea that we have to be talking about voluntary transactions, voluntary conveyances of property, and that a condemnation obviously is not voluntary? How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, I think that the seller's intentions or voluntariness here is not the only relevant point. It's both parties' intentions when the contract was entered into, as manifested by the language. So to say that we're going to craft a standard that just uses what the seller now says his intentions were is not going to work. It's not practical.
I don't think that's his argument. I think the argument is that the word transaction takes on the coloration of the first three, which are voluntary. So it's not that it was his intent not to cover involuntary, but that the language of this contract is.
And we also deal with that also in our brief, and I was getting ready to point out that if you look at the question of was this a volitional act in which he participated, like he would have had he been involved in negotiations give and take with a private purchaser? Yes, indeed, he was.
Who's he?
The appellant, Sundies, the property owner. In this situation, under the provisions of Chapter 32, which govern the way that a condemnation takes place and what must be done, there is heavy involvement by the seller. From day one, and still is today, they're still negotiating about relocation benefits with the advice and assistance of counsel paid for, in fact, in this situation. They are heavily negotiating the price. They are heavily negotiating and are controlled by the provisions of Chapter 32, which guarantee due process and adequate and fair compensation for this deprivation of property. So, yes, indeed, they're very involved, and their involvement is protected. They're entitled to negotiation before they even have a damage award that's recorded. So to say that there is no involvement and that this is an involuntary scenario, like a death, is not worn out by the facts and the circumstances of this case. Therefore, it isn't really a frustrating purpose of this contract.
Let's talk about a death. Let's suppose that I have a palatial condo. I want to sell it, and I have a will, and I want to give all of my estate to the school for the deaf. All right. Before the condo can be sold, I'm hit by a car. So condo goes to the school for the deaf. Does the realtor get the commission?
Well, I think that those facts are very different than what we have here. My first
a transaction.
Yeah, you could say that. But I'm going to say that a transaction is, it certainly encompasses the facts that we have here, which is that adequate compensation, more perhaps than even the list price ultimately will be paid here after these parties finish negotiating the relocation benefits. This isn't a situation where there's a gifted transfer where, because of your very polite will, someone is inheriting a wonderful piece of property. This is a situation where this public body is buying this property and the Sundays are receiving extensive compensation for that conveyance. And therefore, the term transaction clearly could encompass that scenario. There is a give and take back and forth between the public body and the property owner with the assistance of counsel and the assistance of statutory protection that makes certain that that exchange is fair and that it's extensively involved. That's very, very different than a death, which occurs through no action of a third party.
Counsel, I'd like to, I know that we've got three questions here, and so we don't run out of time. I've had one on what we call the last question, the commission question. As I understand it, your client wants 6%, basically. He's going to get $183,000. I just asked the opposing counsel, or I think we determined that there would be roughly at least $2.2. You're basing your commission on $3 million. And the argument that I guess you make is, well, a deal's a deal, and that was what you listed it for, regardless of the price. Doesn't that fall in or fly in the face of when you sell and someone buys, you base the commission on whatever the selling price was? Why here is it different, that you're entitled to the full 6% even though admittedly they've got, say, $1 million less?
I think that the what we have here is you have a lot of situations where people don't like what's in a contract. The contract is written this way to cover.
Well, isn't there, I guess what I'm saying, in the normal real estate transaction, you list and then, at least in my case, generally they go down a little after I list the property, and then you sell it, and then you pay a real estate broker based on the selling price. Why should this be different?
Well, the contracts, I mean, the only reason we're doing this is because the language of the contract says that in lines 57 and 58, that when you have this situation where the transaction results in an effective change of ownership, that it's based on the listing price rather than the actual price. Why does it say that? Because it's encompassing situations that are outside the scope and control of the broker. It's encompassing stocks transfers. It's encompassing scenarios where there's a foreclosure of a lien, that where people don't like the penalty clause, for instance, in the contract. Are we going to start as courts to picking and choosing which contract clauses we think are fair after the fact, in a situation where there's a public, where there is a contractor's lien, for instance, that perhaps the contractor has provided construction on the property and then it gets condemned. He has a lien on the property. Are we going to, and he has a clause in there that imposes 18% interest, or maybe he doesn't have a condemnation clause. Are we going to now start requiring contractors to have condemnation clauses in every contract that's written in which they have perhaps a lien interest in the real estate?
If I might follow through with Justice Wilcox's question, as I understood opposing counsel, he said a provision like this applied in this manner is unconscionable, that it's against public policy. Now, can you tell us why you think it's not unconscionable, why it's not against public policy to have a provision like this?
Yes, I can. First of all, Section 32.13 of the condemnation provisions state that when you have a lien holder, such as we have here, a broker lien, which was in place, or a mortgage lender, that they have the rights in the proceeds of the condemnation sale as a stakeholder. There's nothing in that provision that says that we're going to decide whether that contract, that mortgage, is fair or not, whether the interest rate is the penalties are appropriate. So there are provisions already that are embodied in the statute that cover these rights and that don't indicate that there's any reason for us to attack this. There's no limitation on damage clauses in contracts that are implicated by condemnation. Secondly, the Wisconsin Retired Teachers case that I cited and the Ruppelslaus U.S. Supreme Court case that I cited states that liens are protected property interests, and they're entitled to the same kind of protection that Mr. Sundy is contending or the appellates are contending they are entitled to. And those rights, those contract rights, are property rights that are not to be taken away willy-nilly. Mr. Cole didn't want this to happen either, but it did. And his contract covers this situation and entitles him to the only fair way that you can, after the fact, figure out how much he should get in the way of damages, especially when we have relocation benefits that are in the hundreds, if not millions, here.
Also, could you tell me on the form WB-5 where it says that instead of 6% commission, he gets the commission based on the listing price? I'm not finding that, and I have the form.
It's here. On page 2 at
okay.
the top.
All right.
On line 58, and well, you read 57 through 59.
Okay.
And if you see on line 58, it says based on the list price under sub 3, 4, or 5, and they're referring to sub 3, 4, or 5, which is lines 51, 52, and 53.
Okay.
Sub 4 happens to be a transaction that occurs which causes an effective change in ownership.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I have a suggestion as to an interpretation. Maybe 4 only covers provisions that don't bring the fair market value. And that's why you got a list price. But where you got a transaction that has a fair market value, you take the 6%. And therefore, condemnation doesn't fall under 4 because there's a fair market value payment. Which leads me to another issue as to why aren't you arguing that here there was a sale. May have been involuntary, but in effect, condemnation means that the owner of that property is selling to the government.
Well, I agree with that, and we have argued that. Now, the property owner is involved in those negotiations for that sale price both before the award of damages is made and after. But the award of damages was made, and they filed their lawsuit against Cole before we even knew what was going to happen. So this suit was commenced by Sundy for declaratory judgment very early on in this process.
Well, and do you only earn your commission if you negotiate? I mean, I can see where you put it up on at noon, and it's a hot piece of property, and by 1 o'clock, first guy in there makes an offer, and it's accepted 1:30. You get the 6%, don't you?
Right.
So you don't do it on the basis of how much effort you've done. And
right.
Suppose that instead of an individual, the government comes in on condemnation in the same time frame. Your position is same deal.
Yes, because exactly. First of all, the statute 3205-2A anticipates negotiation occurring either through an agent on behalf of the property owner or an attorney, and certainly a broker can be involved and does and often is involved in negotiating with public bodies on behalf of their clients, and that facilitates, and it's a public benefit to the public to have a broker involved in those transactions rather than depriving him and causing him to never want to list a property that possibly might want to be purchased by a public body.
Was it known in the community that the government was thinking of condemnation here? Is that in the record?
No, it was not. The record shows that Mr. Cole had absolutely no idea that this was going to happen. This property had been listed for 4 years. This was something that the Sundays wanted very badly. And he says in the record that he was happy to be moving and happy he sold his property. He also had an exchange with the CDA, which announced and would have been statutorily required to send letters indicating that it was going to be buying the property and that it was going to be doing so in accordance with the very succinct procedures specified in Chapter 32 and COM 202. So we had ongoing communications by this purchaser that, yes, we're buying this property, yes, this is what we're going to do, these are the terms. The only thing that wasn't decided during that initial listing term was the price. So we had a very similar situation to a buyer that was mulling around thinking about purchasing this property and was telling the seller that it was going to be doing so.
Counsel, if I could follow up on the Chief's question. I'm looking at the contract. I'm looking specifically at lines 125 through 128 and lines 143 and 144. This is a definition section, and it talks about conditions affecting the property or transaction. In looking at those, either the first condition in the number A, plan to commence public improvements which may result in special assessments or otherwise materially affect the property or present use of the property, or sub N, other conditions or occurrences which would significantly reduce the value of the property to a reasonable person with knowledge of the nature and scope of the condition or occurrence. My question is, does this condemnation fall within the definitions of condition affecting the property or transaction? And if it does, what effect, if any, does that have on this contract?
I think that it does, clearly, and that if the Sundays had known about an impending condemnation, they would have had to have told the broker about it. And likewise, that the broker would have had an obligation to tell the Sundays about it. And just
they
like...
tell each other. Then what effect does that have on the
well, then they
contract
would,
between the two?
Then they would make perhaps proceed, or they perhaps might not. But in this situation, we didn't have knowledge of that occurrence. And just like any contract, future occurrences can occur, can take place that people have to weigh the risk of potentially happening.
I guess the reason I'm asking the question is this contract seems to clearly contemplate that a future occurrence can occur, but I don't see where in the contract it provides a resolution of that occurrence or how it should be resolved. Between the
contracts
parties.
Always deal with all sorts of future occurrences. There's a whole myriad of things that can happen. The interest rates can go up. A purchaser can walk in the door. Three purchasers can walk in the door. That's what this contract covers.
But my point is, at least the question is, if the contract calls for this in the definitions, why would it be in the definitions unless there was some anticipation that it could be used within the contract? In other words, you're defining a situation that could materially affect the purchase price of the property, yet you don't give away in the contract, at least there's no way that I can discern in the contract that explains how you deal with them.
Okay, for instance, what if the floor caved in the week after you signed the contract and nobody knew it was a structural defect that affects the value of the property and all of a sudden now the seller has to spend $100,000 to fix it? Okay. That doesn't mean the contract's not valid. It means that that's too bad. I mean, you know, unless they wrote in there that if that happens, he can walk away, he's still obligated by this contract. So I don't think the fact that it's considered material before they entered into it, that it will nullify the contract if it occurs afterwards. And also, with regard to this issue of they should have been more specific and they should have written in, we need condemnation to be covered here before it would. My position is that 779.32, which gives the broker a lien right, and 32.13, which says that stakeholders in condemnation actions have a right to participate in those proceedings, protect contracting parties and give them that right. There is no reason when you have a statutory protection that you have to also reiterate it again in the contract in order to avail yourself of that statutory protection. So my contention would be that the protection is already there, and it would be very unfair to contractors, especially small ones who don't have the benefit of hiring attorneys and brokers who are obligated to use these mandatory forms that are drafted on their behalf, to come up with the concept that they need to write condemnation in here in order to protect themselves from that eventuality.
Could you please describe the process on how these forms are created in the Department of Regulation and Licensing?
Well, and I'm not an expert on this either, and my only input came from Professor Minter, but from what I understand, that they look at common law that is problematic, and they go about correcting it and clarifying. The Department of Regulation and Licensing, which is granted the authority to draft forms under Section 452 sub.05. And that authority, if the courts are the ones that are going to be drafting these forms, an old case law from 1950 is going to say what is covered and what isn't, then the old Eilenfeld case that is cited in this, in the appellant's brief, that says stock sales aren't covered, could not be modified by the language now that clearly was intended to cover stock sales.
There's an advisory committee of some kind?
There is a department that is under the Regulation and Licensing Board, which is involved in the drafting of forms. And as I understand it, it's a group of attorneys and experts and members from the real estate profession who meet and decide how to update these forms.
Well, this language about transaction is relatively new, isn't it?
Yes, it was in 2000 that it was added.
Isn't there some paper record of where that came from?
It was the department. And I get, you mean whether it was an advisory committee or what it was?
Well, if this were the advisory committee here and suddenly this language appeared, did it come from Justice Bradley, or did it come from Justice Butler? Or, I mean, isn't there some record where this came from? Did they record their sessions, or
I believe that that's true. And Professor Minter, who participated, said that they met on more than one occasion and collectively came up with this language.
Why?
He, as he said in his affidavit, to deal with this situation and others like it, where the broker's input is taken away and by circumstances that he has no control over because of the possibility of the parties either causing that to happen to avoid a commission or because things happen that are through no fault of anybody, but that create unfairness to brokers.
Counselor, the word transaction is used multiple times in WB5. Aren't we to assume that every time it's used within the same document, it has the same meaning?
I think that the word transaction is modified by the word occurs in line 52 of the contract, and that the word occurs does not require a participation on the part of the seller. Occurs means to come about. And
I understand that, but I'm talking about the word transaction. I mean, it's used repetitively in this contract. It's not just used on line 125, and it's not just used on this section here, line 52. And I guess my question to you is, why don't we interpret transaction consistently throughout the contract?
Well, I think we do. I think that the word
transaction... Okay, well, that was my question. If you say yes, okay, then I understand better how you would use it.
Counsel, I wonder why we are bothering our pretty heads about the word transaction. I look at the certification by the Court of Appeals, and It refers in some discussion to a case, Kirkpatrick on page 5, and it's for this premise. A condemnation sale price has been held inadmissible to show fair market value. We all know that. It has been long settled, therefore, that a condemnation sale is not an arm's length transaction. This follows a question asked earlier by the Chief. Why isn't this a condemnation sale? Or why isn't this a condemnation offer that we're dealing with? And if it is, then why doesn't sub 1 come into play? Sub 1 deals with when the seller sells or accepts an offer.
Oh, we could characterize it that way. I think when the case was filed, we had a situation where we had an award of damages and a seller who wasn't allowing anybody to represent him and wasn't involved in a situation where there was an offer to purchase in front of him. There was an award of damages that was recorded with the clerk. And so the circumstances of that doesn't smell like a purchase or an accepted offer. It is part of a series of occurrences that culminate in an agreed upon price. But when the case was filed, it was at the early stages. So to just rely on that clause at that time when we were before the trial court seemed unnecessary, especially because we had another clause that is broader and could include.
Has a condemnation, in your opinion, has a condemnation sale occurred yet?
I mean, if you want to call it a condemnation sale, yes, it probably has. But I don't think that the Court of Appeals' conclusion that a condemnation sale is the only evidence of value or is not the evidence of value means that it's not covered under this kind.
No, I don't cite that excerpt from the certification for the value of that legal premise. I cite it only to suggest that this is a condemnation sale, as characterized
by
the Court of Appeals. And if that is a fair characterization, that this is or will be a condemnation sale, then I just don't know why sub 1 doesn't apply.
And I think it arguably could apply. And
if I can follow up Justice Bradley's question, if sub 1 applies, then it would be 6% of the sale price, not the listing price, by the contract.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
If sub 1 applies and you have a sale price, what is the sale price here? We have a whole packet of dollars and proceeds that are coming to this party in addition to just compensation. And we have the costs of the sale. We have the moving expenses, which you wouldn't normally get in a private purchase.
Counsel, your opposing counsel says, well, it should be at least limited to the jurisdictional offer, which was 1-3.
But that's just the beginning of the process. And then why wouldn't they always make a jurisdictional offer to avoid having a broker involved?
That's beside the point. There was a broker involved here. There was a contract. We're trying to determine what the commission should be. So there's been testimony or at least that it's 2.4 or 2.2 or it goes down to 1.3. But the point that my colleagues are making here is that if that's true, then why shouldn't it be based on what was received here, whatever it was?
I can see that argument, except that I wouldn't call this a sale in the general sense of sale. It clearly is something other than that because it has the characteristics of the statute impressed upon it over and above what a sale would have.
Counselor, also, they didn't accept the offer that was made, right? The jurisdictional offer was contested, and they went to trial over it, and they got more money, so it doesn't fit in one if you've got to accept the offer.
Exactly.
I agree with you.
And at the time the case was contested.
How does this say? Sub 1 reads, seller sells or accepts an offer.
And that sounds like, I appreciate that, but when a jurisdictional offer is made, this seller didn't accept it and didn't do a thing. In fact, rejected it wholeheartedly and then filed a lawsuit saying they didn't owe a commission.
Well,
are we going to do that all the time?
It rejects the dollar sum. It accepts the fact that the government is the buyer. Does get title to the property. That's what it accepts. Isn't this like a transaction where you have a voluntary sale, but then something goes a little wrong between the accepted good offer and the closing, and they begin to fight about whether the refrigerator is included or who pays for water damage, etc., right? And it may turn into litigation, right?
Right.
You still, as broker, want a commission on the sale price, right?
And ultimately, if the damages are such that the price is way in excess of the listing price, for instance, because of the litigation, what's fair, the listing price or the price that's ultimately awarded? The listing price. I think that's why they tied it.
But you may have to wait for your money.
And clearly they do.
So it's just like here in a condemnation, the buyer may get, the seller, I'm sorry, the condemnee might get money in, but then still will get more money on the award, right?
Right.
So you just have to sit and wait.
Exactly.
If you're entitled to any commission here.
Exactly.
Which is the issue in the case.
Right.
And your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for the Sundays.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Counsel initially suggests that the WB5 contracts in this case ought not to be construed against her client. And she cites the fact that if the proforer of the contracts proposed construction is reasonable, you don't construe it against the drafter. That's only if that's the only reasonable construction. Where you have two reasonable constructions, you do construe it against the drafter. It's well-settled law. Real estate listing contracts are construed against the broker in this state.
Why isn't this a sale? We're all fussing
yes,
about
that,
the word
that
transaction.
Seems, that
Why
seems
isn't
to be,
this a sale? Under
Your Honor, it is a sale. It is not a sale we contend it is not a sale. In fact, it seems to be well settled law that these are not considered arm's length transactions and thus not sales, as that term is typically used.
Counsel, the way that it's that the court of, and I'm not saying this is correct, I'm just saying with regard to the premise that you just advanced, it's long been settled, therefore, that a condemnation sale is not an arm's length transaction.
Yes, and Your Honor, if you look at the cases in other jurisdictions where this issue has gone to the appellate courts, there has been across the board holdings that condemnations are not sales because the seller gives up or is deprived of some very significant abilities to negotiate what he's looking for.
So
to negotiate,
excuse me, counsel. So the Court of Appeals, and they very well may be
not precise here, but it's your position that when the Court of Appeals uses the term condemnation sale, that that's something that's incorrect?
I think that was shorthand by the Court of Appeals.
Counsel, there wasn't a transfer tax paid on this condemnation, was there?
There is no transfer tax on condemnation. It's exempt under the statutes of the state, Your Honor.
Okay. Do you know what the citation is for that? Because I know it covers all sales, and I'm wondering, is it in the same section of the statute?
It's in the I'd have to defer to Mr. Markovitz. He'd know it by heart. But it's in Chapter 74, and there are, for example, a transfer by a governmental entity is tax-exempt, transfer in condemnation, or in lieu of condemnation.
Thank you. That's all I need to know. I'll find the chapter. Thanks.
This is not a sale because the seller cannot decide how much of his property or whether he wants to convey all of his property. He cannot decide when the occupancy will be given, which was a very important term to the Sundays because of the nature of the military museum operation. They lost all ability to negotiate that. And they had specifically asked that it be handwritten into their listing contract. The only thing they can do when the condemnor comes calling is decide, will I take what they're offering me or will I litigate valuation? That's all a condemnee can do. And, in fact,
couldn't the broker have been very helpful in negotiations?
I think that's very doubtful. I don't think in the real world that's likely. And by the way, the amicus brokers admit that once word of a condemnation is out, you can forget any kind of an arm's length sale or finding any other buyer in reality. Can the broker do much? Likely not. But we also have to bear in mind here that under the WB5 listing contract, the broker would have to have negotiated with the party during the initial term of the listing. They cite only two events, the May 28, 2002 unsolicited visit to Mr. Polakoff, will you buy my client's properties for $2 million? Polakoff says, out. And then on January the 6th, 2003, when the CDA adopts a blight elimination, Mark Sunday stands up at that meeting and says, I don't like you referring to my property as blighted and a junkyard. And then he explains how he got legal non-conforming zoning status. Now, those are the only things that they cite to that occurred during the initial term of this listing, and neither of those things rises to the level of negotiation, I would submit to this court.
Mr. Estinoffis, your time is up.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
I want to thank both counsel on behalf of the court for their formative argument today on yet another condemnation case that this court has. And that concludes the hearing on 2004 AP 2322, Sunday versus Solar Agency. The court will take a few moments in recess so that the students who want to leave will leave and additional people can come to the courthouse. We are in recess.